In the absence of Jim Chaville, it is my pleasure to introduce Galway Kinnell. Mr. Kinnell, who is one of the most vigorous poetic voices of the present generation, is a New Englander born in Providence, Rhode Island, and a graduate of Princeton. He's taught in France and in Iran at the University of Tehran. In 1961, he was awarded a Guggenheim Fellowship and a grant by the National Institute of Arts and Letters. In 1963, he spent 6 months working for CORE in Hammond, Louisiana. Mr. Kinnell has published 2 books of poems, What a Kingdom It Was, and last year, Flower Herding on Mount Monadnock. These two, in addition to a translation of the poetry of François Villon. His poems have appeared frequently in anthologies, among them The Pocketbook of Modern Verse, New Poets of England and America, and the recent collection A Controversy of Poets. The special vigor of Mr. Kinnell's poetry is a result, I think, of his relation to his subject. At a time when the subject of the poem is often only the occasion for a kind of performance, a narcissistic display of style, Mr. Kinnell's natural commitment to his material is liberating and refreshing. An impressive craftsman, he uses craft to define and reveal a world, not to call attention to craft itself. He is authentic. With great pleasure, I give you Galway Kinnell.
Thank you. I'd like to begin by reading a few poems by poets I admire. The first one I'll read is called, is a translation of a poem by an Eskimo. And it's called A Drum Song About a Stupid Kayak Paddler. I always envy them when I hear them sing their drum songs. I amount to nothing. Surely, yes, the art of making poems, the art of capsizing, for that I am not fitted. I have this little folder full of about 20 poems that I read before I read poems of my own, and I'm glad that John Logan is here, because one of them is a passage from his poem Spring of the Thief. To me, it's one of the great passages of modern poetry. The poem itself is too long to read, but it's one perhaps most of you know. It's the one where which starts out where he tries to get in the church and the door is locked and it's not sure if he is locked out or God is. And the passage is just near the end of the poem that I'll read. Ekalov said, "There is a freshness nothing can destroy in us, not even we ourselves. Perhaps that freshness is the changed name of God, where all the monsters also hide. I bear him in the ocean of my blood and in the pulp of my enormous head. He lives beneath the unkempt potter's grass of my belly and chest. I feel his terrible aged heart moving under mine, can see the shadows of the gorgeous light that plays at the edges of his giant eye, of his eternal pool of sperm, like sandalwood. Like sandalwood, The righteous man perfumes the axe that falls on him. Looking at a Face, a short poem by Robert Bly. Conversation. Opening the surfs of the body, bringing the fish of love up, and stiffening the backbones of the sea. I have wandered in a face for hours, passing through dark fires. I have risen to a body not yet born, existing like a light around the body, through which the body moves like a sliding moon. I thought W.S. Merwin's last book, The Moving Target, was by far the best thing he's written. And I don't think many people thought that, because the poems are more obscure than anything he's written. I'd like to read one of them called Recognition. The bird of ash has appeared at our windows, and the roads will turn away mourning. What distances we survived, the fire with its one wing, and I with my blackened heart. I came home as a web to its spider, to teach the flies of my household their songs. I walked in on the mirrors scarred as matchboxes, the gaze of the frames and the ticking in the beams. The shadows had grown a lot, and they clung to the skirts of the lamps. Nothing remembered who I was. The dead turn in their locks, and I wake like a hand on a handle. Tomorrow marches on the old walls, and there is my coat full of darkness in its place on the door. Welcome home, memory. Above Paty Valley by Gary Snyder. We finished clearing the last section of trail by noon. High on the ridge side, 2,000 feet above the creek, reached the pass, went on beyond the white pine groves, granite shoulders, to a small green meadow watered by the snow, edged with aspen, sun straight high and blazing. But the air was cool. Ate a cold fried trout in the trembling shadows. I spied a glitter and found a flake black volcanic glass obsidian by a flower. Hands and knees pushing the bare grass, thousands of arrowhead leavings over 100 yards. Not one good head, just razor flakes on a hill snowed all but summer. A land of fat summer deer. They came to camp on their own trails. I followed my own trail here, picked up the cold drill, pick, single jack, and sack of dynamite. 10,000 years. Well, I guess I'll read now. Little piece by Tu Fu. Night in the Watchtower. While winter daylight shortens in the elemental scale, and snow and frost whiten the cold circling night, stark sounds the fifth watch with a challenge of drum and bugle. The stars and the river of heaven pulse over the three mountains. I hear women in the distance wailing after the battle. I see barbarian fishermen and woodcutters in the dawn. Sleeping dragon, plunging horse, they are no generals now, they are dust. Hush for a moment, O tumult of the world. I was thinking of reading a long poem that I wrote quite long ago, but since John Logan is here and he's heard this God knows how many times, I think I'll read something else for his sake. Maybe I will read it, but first I'll read some other shorter poems. Here is a poem untitled. I hesitate at these Michaelmas daisies, perhaps the way a child, crayon in hand, hesitates over his first coloring book, dreading to cross into his first lesson in absence. I can see the earth-colored Spanish vase glaze overflowing it, holding their blooms against the plain white mur de fédéré in the living room where we put wildflowers to die. Is to color them into this corner of a room to save them or only lament them flagrantly? This is called A Night in the Ruins. I remember the last haze on the mountains, the bluish purple of eternity, and a last bird crossing over before the snow, flop, flop, adoring only the instant. And years ago, in a constellation that rumbled above the Atlantic all night, I remember seeing, illuminated by lightning bolts jumping out of it, a thunderhead formed a little like the face of my brother, looking nostalgically down on blue, lightning-flashed moments of the Atlantic. Wind tears itself in the eaves of my ruins, as though I were hearing the snowdrifts building themselves out there in the darkness, across fields where I have watched dawns and known clouds and rain, upside-down ravines in which our few saving presences are thrown to die. Silence. Only the cow of nothingness mooing softly down the bone marrow. Until, is it a rooster? I can see him as he scratches in the dewy earth for a grain, finds it, rips it up, flaps, crows, flames bursting out of his brow. How many nights must it take one such as me to learn that we aren't, after all, made of the bits of that bird which creates itself out of its ashes, that for a man, as he goes up in flames, his one work is to open himself to be the flames. Well, here's a poem called The Poem as Compulsive Naming. And it's really the offshoot of a long poem, part of a long poem I pared away once. And so I'm not really sure if it's a poem. I read it a few days ago, and someone came up to me afterwards and said it wasn't. That its value was in shocking the bourgeois, but it has no aesthetic qualities whatsoever. But I wasn't willing yet to accept that judgment, so I'll read it for its aesthetic qualities. It occurred to me that county jails, that if poetry is concerned with giving names to what is unnamed, county jails, which don't have any name except that of the county in which they're located, ought to be good, deserving subject matter. The county jails that go by the name of their county have well deserved a name of their own, some honeyed distinguishing phrase from the muse. I propose nothing fancy, but handles poetic, useful, and rough. Bidet of rat, shitpot of spirochetti, crap can of crabs. Hell, what's the point of trying to be satiric about county jails in a poem? Let's see. Piss house of bedbug, puke bag of flea. Well, that's all it is. I guess it isn't a poem, actually. This poem is called The Poem. It's in 10 parts, very small parts. And there's a section in it in which poems whose names we know, but which themselves have disappeared, are listed, such as one place Chaucer gives a list of his works and mentions the Book of the Lion, which nobody's ever seen, and so with all the other poems in that section. And then The Onions is mentioned toward the end. That has a capital T and a capital O with quotation marks around it. Otherwise you'd think it was just some onions, but it's meant to be a poem called The Onions. On this hill crossed by the last birds, a sprinkling of soil covers up the rocks with green, as a face drifts on the skull scratched with glaciers. The poem, too, is a kind of palimpsest, streaked with erasures, smelling of departure and burnt stone. A gust of wind blows through the oaks that don't give up their dead leaves. The full moon slides forth suddenly. The trees' graves all lie out an instant at their feet. The leaf-shaped tongue of the newborn and the dying rattles, and no one interprets it. Where is the apocalypse of Lamech? Where is the Ilu Persis? Where is the Havadnameh? Where is the Book of the Lion? Where is the Serventose of the 60 girls of Florence? Where are the small poems Li Po tore up and scattered on the moving waters? Where are all the snows that sank in these graves? Day starts to crawl up the hills. Everyone who thought the night of most of our lives would be endless shrugs, saying, what good is the day? On our hill of despair, the bonfire we kindled has lighted the great sky. Though it's true, of course, to make it burn, we had to throw ourselves in. On fields littered with wishbones, funny bones, jaw bones, fist bones unclasping from dollars and submachine guns, nameless bones, the sacrums desecrated, astrologi from which the butterflies have flown, we hunt the wild hummingbird who nests in pokeweed sprouting, pismired rib cages dumped down here and there. On a branch in the morning light, lying on its back at the tip of an icicle, the letter C comes into being, trembles to drop or to cling. A Romanesque carapace glitters all over it. Icicle nails itself the fourth stroke in. They're chainsawing pine logs up for pulp in the snowfields. Under all the screams, the gold smile of the Buddha spills itself out again. Here is a hen feather binding utter to the reflection of illum. Here is a lightning split fur, the lines down its good side, becoming more and more Whitmanesque and free. Here is unfulfilled, reflected as malefica along the feather of a crow. Here is a hound running after his bitch in trochaic dimeter brachycatalectic. Here are the pits where the tongue bone is hurled at its desolate cry. Here is green being peeled off a tomato a little a day. Here is an armful of last year's snows. The moment in the late night when baby birds folded in dark wings almost stir, and the objects grow strangely heavy, hugged by an incalculable gravity. The hand trembles at the surgery of the funeral and of the funeral oration. The absence in a poem it will have left in the world of blank. Where are the onions that I saw swollen with tears on a grocery shelf in 1948? Brong, ding, plang, ching of a spike I've hammered crazy on a locust post. I don't really think I have time to read that long poem, so I'll read a few more less lengthy ones. This is called To a Child in Calcutta. Dark child in my arms. I might say a word about this poem before I begin, lest it isn't very clear to whom it's written. It's written to a child who was photographed once that I found on the street of in Calcutta. And I had a camera, and its photograph was taken in while I was holding it, and then I was asked to send the picture to the parents. And so this is to accompany the picture, so to speak. Dark child in my arms, eyes the whites of them just like mine, gazing with black shined canniness at mine like large agates in a billboard, whom I held as a passerby a few stricken days down Banduk Gully while they were singing upstairs. Everyone in Calcutta is knocking at my door. You are my conqueror. and you were calmly taking in my colored eyes and skin burned and thin and browned hardly at all by your Bengal sun. If they show you, when you reach my age, the blown-up snapshot they took of the stranger holding all you once were in his arms, what will you be able to think then of the one who came from some elsewhere and took you in his arms and let you know the touch of a father and the old warmth in a paw from nowhere, but that in his nowhere he will be dying, letting go his hold on all for which his heart tore itself, as when they snapped you in his arms like his child, and going by the photograph that there was this man, his hair in his eyes, his hand bigger than your whole head, who held you when helplessly you let him, that between him and you were this gesture and this allowance, and he is your stranger father, and he dies in a strange land which is his own. In Calcutta, I thought, every pimp, taxi driver, whore, and beggar doused for me through the alleys day and night. In Bandup Guli, I came upon you on a street crossed by fading songs. I held you in my arms until you slept, in these arms, in rags, in the pain of a little flesh. Middle of the way. This poem has three parts, the first and third parts in verse, and the second page, and each of those describe the night surrounding the day, which is described in the second part in prose as a kind of diary. In the coastal range of Oregon, the poem is set. I wake in the night, an old ache in the shoulder blades. I lie amazed under the trees that creak a little in the dark, the giant trees of the world. I lie on earth the way flames lie in the woodpile, or as an imprint in sperm of what is to be. I love the earth, and always in its darknesses I am a stranger. 6 a.m., water frozen, melted it and made tea, ate a raw egg and the last orange, refreshed by a long sleep, the trail practically indistinguishable under 8 inches of snow. 9:30 a.m., snow up to my knees in places, sweat begins freezing under my shirt when I stop to rest. The woods are filled anyway with the windy noise of the first streams. 10:30 a.m., the sun at last. The snow starts to melt off the boughs at once, falling with little ticking sounds. Mist clouds are lying in the valleys. 11:45 a.m., slow, glittering breakers roll in on the beaches 10 miles away. Very blue and calm, as if it were Honolulu down there. Odd to see it while sitting in snow. 12 noon. An inexplicable sense of joy, as if some happy news had been transmitted to me directly, bypassing the brain. 2 p.m. From the top of Goldie, I look back into Hebo Valley. Castle Rock sticks into a cloud. A cool breeze comes up from the valley. It is a fresh, earthly wind and tastes of snow and trees. It is not like those transcendental breezes that make the heart ache. It brings happiness. 2:30 p.m. Lost the trail. A big woodpecker watches me wade about through the snow, trying to locate it. The sun has gone back of the trees. 3:10 p.m. Still hunting for the trail. Getting cold. From an elevation, I have an open view to the southeast. A world of timberless white hills rolling, weirdly wrinkled. Above them, a pale half moon. 3:45 p.m., going on by map and compass. 7:30 p.m., made camp near the head of Alder Creek, trampled a bed into the snow and filled it with boughs, concocted a little fire in the darkness, ate pork and beans, a slug or two of whiskey burnt my throat. The night very clear, very cold. That half moon is up there, and a lot of stars have come out among the treetops. The fire has fallen to coals. The coals go out. The last smoke weaves up, losing itself in the stars. This is my first night to lie in the uncreating dark. In the heart of a man there sleeps a green worm that has spun the heart about itself, and that shall dream itself black wings one day to break free into the beautiful black sky. I leave my eyes open. I lie here and forget our life. All I see is we float out into the emptiness among the great stars on this little vessel without lights. I know that I love the day, the sun on the mountain, the Pacific shiny and accomplishing itself in breakers. But I know I live half alive in the world. I know half my life belongs to the wild darkness. This poem is called The River That Is East. It's in four parts. And there's a reference at the end to a high window in Brooklyn. And I had in mind that window Hart Crane used to speak of in his letters, that he would look out from to see the East River and the Brooklyn Bridge when he was writing his poem. Buoys begin clanging like churches and peter out. Sunk to the gunwales in their shapes, tugs push upstream. A car float booms down, sweeping past illusory suns that blaze in puddles on the shores where it rained, past the Navy Yard, under the Williamsburg Bridge that hangs face down from its strings over which the Jamaica local crawls, through white-winged gulls which shriek and flap from the water and sideslip in over the chaos of illusions, dangling limp red hands and screaming as they touch. A boy swings his legs from the pier. His days go by. Tugs and car floats go by, each prow pushing a white cap. On his deathbed, Kane remembered the abrupt mist grail called Rosebud. Gatsby must have thought back on his days digging clams in Little Girl Bay in Minnesota. Nick fished in dreamy Michigan. Gant had his memories, Griffiths, those who went baying after the immaterial and whiffed its strange dazzle in a blonde in a canary convertible, who died thinking of the Huck Finns of themselves on the old afternoons, themselves like this boy swinging his legs, who sees the Ile-de-France come in and wonders if, in some stateroom, there is not a sick-hearted heiress sitting, drink in hand, saying to herself his name. A man stands on the pier. He has long since stopped wishing his heart were full or his life dear to him. He watches the snowfall hitting the dirty water. He thinks, beautiful, beautiful. If I were a gull, I would be one with white wings. I would fly out over the water, explode, and be beautiful snow hitting the dirty water. We stand on the shore, which is mist beneath us, and regard the onflowing river. Sometimes it seems the river stops, and the shore flows into the past. Nevertheless, its leaked promises hopping in the bloodstream, we do strain for the future. Sometimes even glimpse it, a vague, scummed thing we dare not recognize, and peer again at the cabled shroud out of which it came. We who have no roots but the shifts of our pain, no flowering but our own strange lives. What is this river but the one which drags the things we love, processions of debris like floating lamps, toward the radiance in which they go out? No, it is the river that is east, known once from a high window in Brooklyn in agony, river on which a door locked to the water floats, a window sash paned with brown water, a whiskey crate, barrel staves, sun spokes, feathers of the birds, a bread crust, a rat, spittle, butts and peels, the immaculate stream, heavy and swinging home again. I'll close by reading Flower Herding on Mount Monadnock, which has ten very short parts. I can support it no longer. Laughing ruefully at myself for all I claim to have suffered, I get up. Damned nightmarer. It is New Hampshire out here. It is nearly the dawn. The song of the whippoorwill stops, and the dimension of depth seizes everything. The song of a Peabody bird goes overhead like a needle pushed five times through the air. It enters the leaves and comes out little changed. The air is so still that as they go off through the trees, the love songs of birds do not get any fainter. The last memory I have is of a flower which cannot be touched, through the bloom of which all day fly crazed missing bees. As I climb, sweat gets up my nostrils. For an instant I think I am at the sea. One summer off Cap Ferrat, we watched a black seagull straining for the dawn. We stood in the surf. Grasshoppers splash up where I step. The mountain laurel crashes at my thighs. There is something joyous in the elegies of birds. They seem caught up in a formal delight, though the morning dove whistles of despair. But at last, in the thousand elegies, the dead rise in our hearts. On the brink of our happiness, we stop like someone on a drunk starting to weep. I kneel at a pool. I look through my face at the bacteria I think I see crawling through the moss. My face sees me. The water stirs. The face, looking preoccupied, gets knocked from its bones. I weighed 11 pounds at birth, having stayed on 2 extra weeks in the womb. Tempted by room and fresh air, I came out big as a policeman, blue-faced with narrow red eyes. It was 8 days before the doctor would scare my mother with me. Turning and craning in the vines, I can make out through the leaves the old shimmering nothingness, the sky. Green, scaly moose woods ascend, tenants of the shaken paradise. At every wind, last night's rain comes splattering from the leaves. It drops in flurries and lies there, the footsteps of some running start. From a rock, a waterfall, a single trickle like a strand of wire, breaks into beads halfway down. I know the birds fly off, but the hug of the earth wraps with moss their graves and the giant boulders. In the forest, I discover a flower. The invisible life of the thing goes up in flames that are invisible, like cellophane burning in the sunlight. It burns up, its drift is to be nothing. In its covertness, it has a way of uttering itself in place of itself. Its blossoms claim to float in the empyrean, a wrathful presence on the blur of the ground. The appeal to heaven breaks off. The petals begin to fall in self-forgiveness. It is a flower. On this mountainside, it is dying. Thank you.